It's difficult to preach on such a well-known story. It has to do with the fact that we have not only heard it so often, so many times, but also because we have settled on our opinion of what we think it means. And when that happens, we keep it at a distance from us. We do not allow the story and the Spirit to conspire to really challenge us, to really do its work on us afresh. That is why we refer to the Bible as the living Word, because it is not a stale utterance of words cobbled together 2,000 years ago and beyond. But it is animated by the very Spirit of God to come alive now with vibrancy and relevance and pertinence to our life and to the world in which we live. So how may we open to it? I know there's some, when they come to this particular text, they feel that the miraculous tones of it are almost insulting, given the reality of the number of people in dire starvation around our world. That somehow, if Jesus can indeed do this multiplication, why is God not multiplying sufficient for all the needs of those in the world? Did not the Psalm say that God supplies the needs for all that God has made? God opens God's hand, the psalmist says. So there's that disconnect, that material way of looking at it that sometimes causes people to push it aside. There's a wonderful poem I came across by William Loder that captures some of the sentiments poetically of those of which I have just spoken. I want to share some of that psalm. It's from the perspective of a mother in the midst of a starving country and situation of famine, reflecting on her reality juxtaposed with what seems to be coming forth from this text. Dust on her muddied feet, still smeared from the wet and now blue with cold, hands stretched out in a meaningless pose of begging, for UN relief supplies reached the camp only late in the afternoon. Drawn faced children with bulging bellies, listless, some sleeping, many dying. Time, time to live and time to die. Time to think. If only, but too tired, too undernourished. Time, but no strength to be profound, to reflect, to meditate, makes the dying easier, the pain less revolutionary. So don't ask me to think. Why do you tell stories? Why do you tell me stories about food? Why torment me with your miracles of plenty and multiplication? Where have the bread breakers gone? If only there were such multipliers of loaves and fish, we'll give them the fish, we'll offer the loaves, but these are your fantasies, romantic images of antiquity, best left to their glint and pass by. They never were a model for future followers. At most, they are remnants of propaganda, stunning feats to woo the faithful who want to crown him as king. See him that dark night upon the deep restless craving that threatens to engulf him, drawing him into the universal oblivion, the ocean of acclaim ready to drown the spirit, swallow the word. He beats a path to the deep, the magic of the monsters, turn triumphant for good. Yeah, it's him all right. Come on, you guys, James and John, let's drag the boat. Look at this pile of fish. How many of you reckon? 153? Why are you so hungry? There's no bread left over for us in this camp. All the baskets are empty. All the bellies are full, bloated with nothingness. Why so insatiable? Why so greedy? Why so obsessed to munch on stories of plenty, meals you will never understand? Come with me to the dark places. See the stones that cry out. Watch him poised to market bread from rock. Poised to fail, poised for fantastic feats. Hear his words, the mouth of God. but giving words of grace, of hope, if counsel. There's always this ache down here, always this ache. You fill it with Coca-Cola, but it's still there. It needs blood, it needs wine, it needs bread. Why don't you feel the ache? Why don't you feel the ache? The poet is inviting us to a deeper engagement. For we can look and dismiss the story as not accomplishing the world hunger targets in this day and generation. But I want to suggest to you that this story from John chapter 6 tries to get behind that which prevents us, that which inhibits us from engaging in what is very much possible. We're told by economists and geographers and anthropologists, we're told by politicians, some of them, the problem is not the availability of food. The earth, even in its present state, with all of the pollution and the challenges it has the capacity to produce enough food for everyone. We're told that over and over. The problem is not production. The problem is distribution. At heart, really, the problem is greed. The problem is apathy. The problem is a self-sufficiency that cuts us off from others. That's the problem. And so this story, rather than deal with what looks like the obvious reality, is trying to get behind the scenes into our lives, into our hearts, into our souls, into our communities, into our churches, into our theologies. So let us look more carefully at the story and see if we are correct, if we are truly able to stand on ceremony about how audacious the claims are compared to the reality of the world. The crowd that follows Jesus do so because they have seen signs. We're going to learn fairly shortly, later on in chapter 6 and beyond, that this crowd is a fickle crowd. Now, this is not new to us because we know crowds being mentioned in the Gospels have been fickle before. Hail him, the King of David! Hosanna! A few days later, crucify him, crucify. We know crowds can be fickle. We know we can be fickle. The crowds have seen signs, and so they follow him. He goes over the lake to the other side, and they follow along, coming, wanting, yearning. Why are they following? Because they saw miraculous signs that he has undertaken and he has performed for the sick. Maybe if he's done them for those folks, he can do them for us also. They come out of their own wanting, their own purposes, their own needs, as it were. What is interesting about this is that as they come and Jesus goes up the mountainside, Jesus looks and sees the crowd coming. And the text in this particular, in John's rendering, don't tell us that the crowd is hungry. In fact, they are looking for miraculous things with respect to their health and so forth. It doesn't tell us that they're hungry. It's interesting that it is Jesus who speaks a word into them, an intrusive word, because Jesus recognized what they really need. And he's going to use that metaphor of food in order to get behind their defenses and expose what is really at the root of his purpose for coming. So it is Jesus who initiates the offering, as it were, and he says to Philip, where are we going to get something, food to buy? And that's an important question, because that is the question that you and I ask and need to answer each day. Where are we going to get the resources for our life? Where are we going to get the direction and purpose for our living? Where are we going to get the faith? Where are we going to get the compassion needed to live in this world? Where are we going to get the energy to commit to the things that God has called us to do? Where are we going to get what is necessary to do? That question, where, is a good one. Now, what we see is that, again, the disciples are thinking on a particular plane. Notice what happens. Where will we buy this? And the text tells us he's being tested. Sometimes we do need to be tested to see if we can deconfirm or unconfirm our settled notions. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages will not buy enough food. What is he thinking? You know the script. Let's try this project. Let's see if we can be bold and engage the neighborhood in this way. Oh, can't afford it. Can't afford it. Cut it short. Can't afford it. Budget won't allow. Where are we going to get it? As if it all depended on us or me. Jesus asks, where are you going to get this? Because what we're soon going to see, and it's very interesting that just before, notice the literary purpose and genius of John. Just before asking that, there's a little throwaway comment that John includes. It says, the Jewish Passover feast was near. So if it was near, and these are Jews who are very much getting in the mood, so to speak, or anticipating Passover, one of the three main festivals, what does the Passover celebrate? What does it celebrate? The Passover celebrates the generous provision of God. The Passover celebrates the deliverance of God and the providing for people in the midst of very torturous circumstances through the wilderness. It's God's provision, not their making. They're not growing crops. They're not harvesting. They are in receipt of what God has given. So here we have a throwaway comment that tells you it is from God. Then the question is asked, where are you going to get? It's like the answer has been given. But he misses it. Not going to get it from our earnings, 8 months' wages. Where are we going to get? It's going to come from God. How it's going to come from God? Well, let's wait and see. But the where question is answered. It is answered for you and for me even today. Where am I going to get the help I need to deal with my own crisis of identity, to deal with the fracture in my relationships, to deal with the lack of purpose and direction that I have, to deal with this no-end, dead-end job and the threat that it may be taken away? Where am I going to get the resources to deal with these things in my life? And the text is trying to throw away and give us the answer. It's going to come from God. It's going to come at God's provision. Now, how? Let's explore that. Once we get the where, and we shift our confidence and shift our reliance, not on our own efforts to strive, but on the ultimate source of giving, God. That doesn't mean there's not a place for us. So we go on to look at the text, and we see as it unfolds the way in which the origin of the where, God, participates and cooperates with us. What is found as the people sit down? What happens? A little boy comes with his lunch. Now, there are some important things about this. Two, and one that I missed before. You know, I've preached on this text several times, and I missed it because it is part of the theme of the abundant provision of God. Look at the phrase in verse 10. In verse 10, it says, Jesus said, have the people sit down. And that's fine, that instruction. But for somehow, I had some sort of mental cramp for years and years and never really noticed this. The next phrase says, there was plenty of grass in that place. And so the men sat down, about 5,000 of that. I'd always glossed over that. There was plenty of grass to sit down. Do you hear that? Who provides the grass? Who provides the comfort and the venue and the possibility for people to sit and have what is necessary? Who provides that? The answer goes back to the Passover theme. It is God. You see, abundance is all around us. And in the face of abundance, too often we are like the disciples and we say, well, we don't have enough money. Where are we going to get the resources? How can we do this? It's impossible. It's impossible. And yet all around us, if we would open the commonplace things of God's provision are all around. There's plenty of grass. There's plenty of abilities. There are plenty of resources. There are plenty of ideas. There's plenty of energy. There's plenty of what is necessary to do. All we have to do is to allow that Jesus factor to be a part of all of our planning and all of our hoping and all of our aspirations. And it's amazing when the provisions of God, taken for granted so often by us, are brought intentionally into focus, are positioned with the gift of Christ, what can happen? So we see the Passover theme, the provision of God. Plenty of grass, all that is provided is there already. The hints are burgeoning all around. Abundance is already there. And in the midst of that abundance then comes an act of generosity. For the boy comes and offers what he has. Jesus conspires with the offering of the boy, the prayer that is offered to multiply the already provided abundance of God. Do you see? It is not all up to us, but it includes us. Very significant thing about the description about this boy is that it tells us something that people who go on these trips overseas and observe people in developing countries and the poverty and so forth often come back with a certain observation. Not only two things I often hear from people. One is that there seems to be so much joy and they have so little. Does that sound familiar to you? People say that. The other thing that is often said is that although experiences where people have traveled and been with those who are economically poor and have run into difficulties or observed things, it seems like those who have the least are most willing to share. Have you heard that also before? There's a significant detail in here that suggests a certain confirmation of that. And what is that? What is described here that this boy brings, and the words in Greek help us to get a deeper sense. 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Now barley loaves, usually they would be wheat loaves that are offered. Barley loaves were those that the poor used. The poor could only afford the barley loaves. And the description of the fish is not fresh fish. It is fish that has been dried, cured. Again, more often the staple of the poor. This boy has what he has. What he has describes his economic state, that of his family, but it does not describe the state of his heart and his generosity. So what we see are signals in here all throughout the text that open us and excavate our deep motivations about what is holding us back from making a reality of that poem I opened with. What is it that frustrates the human capacity to do what we could do if we all joined together and feed the world? We could do it. We could. But there's some things that are holding us back. And I think that Jesus is trying to get at the text of that. It has to do with our identity. It has to do with the narrative that we give ourselves to. The narrative of scarcity or abundance and generosity are the order of the day. That there is enough. That the plentiful provision of God is always abundantly given. And I wonder if it has something to do with the observation in the article that I read recently from a recent edition of Atlantic in May, just a month or so ago, made some interesting observations. The title of the article is Facebook Making Us Lonely? And the author goes on, Stephen Marsh goes on to tell some stories and use some statistics and studies about the increasing alienation that is felt as people in North America. He's dealing mostly with America, but also references to North America. The more connected we have, we have more connectivity and less intimacy. We're more wired and plugged in and less meaningfully connected. He opens with a story of Yvette Vickers. Unless you're a real movie buff, you wouldn't recognize that name. She was a former Playboy playmate, but best known for her role in that old B-movie, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. She died last year at age 83, alone. What is shocking about her death and the circumstances of it is that she lay dead for almost 1 year before she was discovered by a neighbor, a fellow movie star, Susan Savage, who saw cobwebs forming all over the front porch and yellowed mail and flyers and all kinds of things. And finally, one day, went and reached through a broken window to unhinge the door and to go inside with mounds of papers and mail and things that were there, clothes and a stench, to go upstairs and find her mummified body on the floor. 1 year. And what was interesting is that Mars goes on to point out that as news of her death and the circumstances were revealed, that item went viral. There were 16,000 Facebook posts and 881 tweets about it. She was more famous in the circumstances of her death than in the latter months of her life. And a newspaper got hold of the story and began to investigate what were her contacts in the last few months of her life. Went through her phone bills and internet records and so forth. And found out that she had reached out not to her friends and not to her family, from whom she felt alienated and disconnected, but had reached out to fans in different countries around the world that she only knew online. Shallow communications, desperate attempts for somebody to care. Mars goes on to talk about the loneliness that is felt, and increasingly so. In 2010, survey found that 35% of adults older than 45 were chronically lonely, as opposed to 20% of a similar group only a decade earlier. 60 million people, 20% of Americans, 60 million people are unhappy with their lives because of loneliness. Marriage can help, but not necessarily, only if the spouse is a confidant. Only if there's a sense of connection and similarities of sharing, intentional sharing. Otherwise, it can be a very lonely marriage. Belief in God can help or not help. A German study, he's reporting in 1990, found that comparing levels of religious feeling and levels of loneliness discovered active believers who saw God as abstract and helpful rather than a wrathful immediate presence were less lonely. So in other words, it depends on how you view God's role in your life. Believing in God in and of itself is not a cure or addresses the questions of loneliness. It has to do with whether you are connected and feel, as the psalmist says, that God does take care of whom God loves. That God, there is enough love and food for all. That this means something and I'm willingly and intentionally engaging in this act of belief. And what that does is not only settle my account of my own life, but it animates me to reach out and to care for other people in deep ways. Because my spirit has been fed, because my life has been ordered in the way that I am meant to be. So loneliness, I believe, is one of the ways in which we talk about our disconnection from community. And it is the sense of deep community, authentic, rich community, thriving community, such as that which we're trying to create here at Parkdale, that creates the atmosphere necessary not only to push back loneliness, but to be available in faithfulness to God. It is so stark that people are spending more time on Facebook, on digital media, than in their personal relationships. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a Luddite. It can be used if you use that digital media and social media in order to organize face-to-face contact. This is people are much better off. But when it is a replacement for face-to-face contact, people are not recognizing they're growing increasingly isolated and lonely. Some of you may have read the story last week or 2 weeks ago. In the paper, a New Yorker, 29 master's students in New York, Jackie Samuel, has decided to open a snuggery in her apartment. Now, she'll always have other people there, but what it is, for $60 an hour, you can come and she will snuggle with you. Because people are starved for human touch. They have to pay someone to hold them. She emphasizes it is a non-sexual contact. Clothes have to be on all the time. But you can come and you can be snuggled. You can be held. You can be, you know, given that sense of human contact for $60 an hour. And her business is booming.
It says something about our sense of disconnection. When you are lonely, when you feel disconnected, when you feel your life is certainly spinning out of control, you are less likely to be concerned about feeding people, caring for people, being an instrument of God in the world. So this particular text is inviting us to get behind the scenes and to find out what is at play. Is it that we do not recognize the abundance of God? Is it that we have absented ourselves from the community necessary? What Jesus was doing by having them sit down, this band of crowd, this fickle crowd, I don't think he was successful, but certainly attempted, have them sit down and share a meal together from the common hand of God. That is a community forming gesture. But instead of recognizing it as such, what we see is that they were somehow able to shift and turn that attempt at community formation, that attempt at opening to God's generosity, into their own personal needs. Because what do we read? We read that at the end, they come and they try to make Jesus their king. Now, their understanding of kingship is that he's going to make food for us every day. And the level of material provision, not the deep sense of yearning behind them. He was trying to come and say, I am the bread of life, the deep spiritual resources, the sense of faith, the sense of purpose and communion, the love and the compassion, the generosity, the justice, all those things that come forth. This is what I am calling you to. Don't be persistent getters, as it were. You get in order to give. In 1719, the German religious man Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf, he climbed the stone steps of the art gallery in Düsseldorf. He was trying to move around and just kind of meditate, as it were, on paintings and see the spiritual value of those. And in May 20th, 1790, it was his fifth art gallery, and he'd settled down and strolled around, taking in the various masterpieces that were there. And on this particular day, he went to this art gallery. And for some reason, he came upon a particular painting. He was attracted to it. And he stopped and he studied it closely. It was a painting by Domenico Fetti, entitled Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, in Latin. And it showed Jesus with a crown of thorns on his head. And at the bottom of the picture, the artist had painted the words, "This I have done for you. What will you do for me?" The painting was suggesting Jesus has given as the bread that which will feed our spirits and feed our lives and feed the world. How will we respond to that which we have given? And to see the combination of worship and justice and feeding and purpose and God's generosity coming together. I remember 5 years ago. Yes, 5 years ago. I think I shared this story with the congregation before. I was in Atlanta attending the preaching conference I often go to. No, not Atlanta, sorry. It was Tennessee. It was, Nashville, Tennessee. And at the final service, we had been, you know, talking about transforming preaching and how it engages and animates the congregation to not only consume good preaching, as it were, but what it actually accomplished in the day-to-day life, in the Monday to Saturday life. What did that do? And after the final service, in which I was part of the final service and offering communion, I asked the conference if I could take the leftover elements. As you know, often at communion there are leftover bread and wine and so forth, and to go into the street. Because you see, for all week we had been moving between First Baptist Church and the Tennessee Performing Arts Center, where some of the conference was taking place. And as we walked by there, there was a central fountain and downtown park where a lot of homeless people were. Every day they would walk by. And walking by, we began to develop a relationship, stopping and talking with some of them. Came across a fellow who was an activist, talking about trying to challenge the churches and challenge the city to look at the needs of the poor and the homeless. And so I asked the conference if I could take that and gather the communion. And anyone who wanted could come with me, and we were going to have a service at the park. We were going to just talk with people and share the generosity of God, these elements of wine and bread. But more significantly, the relationship. There were three people that joined me. And we went and we had a wonderful time. It was incredible because some of the people said, I never thought I would have communion again. I used to go to a church, but since I look like this and what's happened to me, I don't go near a church anymore. Nobody cares about me. We brought that to them. We shared in communion and we laughed and kicked up a storm in that park. But there's something more. There's the people that had a little experience of that, and that was deeply meaningful. We heard over and over the women, the men, and in all of their grubby clothes and so forth, talked about how significant that was. But I said, you know what? This is great. We're having a good time. But I bet y'all are still hungry. Yeah. We went across the park to a little Subway restaurant. It was an incredible scene. We walked in, and I went and told the manager that there's some folks that are going to be coming in, and they're my guests. Because what I learned very soon, quickly, is that all of them from the park had been banned from this store. They would call the police if they came, because they would be begging and asking for food as people left. And if there were anything in the garbage, they would be going to the garbage. And he thought there were causing people not to come to his restaurant. So I said, they're my guests. And I'm going to pay for them, the three of them, the three of others who came from the conference. And in marched 22 of the folks from the park with their bags. I told them, leave the shopping carts outside, but with their bags and all the things. And they came and they said, Anthony, can we have anything? Sure, have a foot-long sub. Have it all. And as soon as they came in, most of the people in the restaurant left. Because of the smell and the way they looked. I don't know. But there they came through getting the chips and the cookies and the whatever. Not the most nutritious meal. Although some of the sandwiches were pretty good. And sat down and we took over that restaurant. And the laughter and the decibel. And the manager, I had gone and spoken to him. And I said, don't you dare call the police. And I told him who we were from the conference and the church and so forth. And I said, this will not look very good for you if we talk about what you do, what you're planning to do. We just backed off. And we had our time there. But part of it was the discussion about what could be done as strategies now, not only for this particular restaurant owner, but for those who were there to go and speak to the churches. And out of that encounter came a strategy with those who were serving as activists to begin to speak to the coalition of churches and the others about doing something in Nashville for the homeless and for the poor. Bread and wine. Community, resources, provision of God and abundance. What was the key? It was Jesus. The Jesus factor brings all of these things, reminds us of God's generosity and provision. The manna in the desert, made reference to in Passover. All of the folks who gathered around brought what they had. Ideas, pain, stories that could begin to coalesce into a strategy. And the food of the restaurant, grudging manager and all. All used by God to accomplish something. We can do it. Text says we can do it. Jesus says we can do it. So if you want to dismiss the story because it doesn't feed all the poor today, you've missed the point. Release what is possible when God conspires with us. And that commingling of generosity and faith and trust releases the impossible. There's love and there's food enough for all. Amen.